Welcome to the Now Spinning Magazine podcast with me, Phil Aston. On this episode, I'm so happy to be joined by Robin George, who since the 1980s has built up a name for himself as a guitar player, musician, producer, songwriter, and solo artist. Robin talks about his latest album and looks back at his career, which is like a who's who in the world of rock and roll. Okay, hello and welcome to the Now Spinning Magazine podcast with me, Phil Aston, and I'm absolutely delighted to say that today, for this episode, I'm joined by guitarist, multi-talented instrumentalist, producer, solo artist, Robin George. You may know Robin or remember Robin from his very big radio and video hit, Heartline, from the album Dangerous Music. However, even if you don't, I imagine if you're a rock fan and you look through your record collection, Robin's name will pop up in all sorts of different places. So Robin's going to be talking about his latest album and his latest projects, but I thought we'd start off rolling back to near the beginning, when you got your first guitar, which was a Watkins Rapier 33. So it was a bright red guitar.
It was bright red, but wrong. Ah. My first ever guitar was a plastic four-string like ukulele-ish thing with the pictures of the Beatles on. And my mum bought it me when I was 7 or 8. And we were staying with friends for Christmas. There was an uncle there who knew 3 chords, and he taught them me with, you know, like one-finger chords, you know, where you mute some strings. And he said, you can play any song in the world on this. He was wrong, but that was how I started.
Wow.
But the first electric guitar, yeah, was the Rapier 33. And I don't know how I got it, but I did. Oh, yeah, I swapped an acoustic.
Yeah.
With a friend of mine whose name was Robin Chatterjee.
Oh, yeah.
And his dad couldn't stand the electric. So I just did a straight swap with an acoustic, and we were both really happy.
Fantastic.
And his dad was.
So you were, you also, because you were expelled, but you were a proper rock and roller very early on, because you were expelled from school, weren't you, at a couple of times?
It's either rock and roll or just being, I just wanted to play guitar, to be honest with you. And I remember at the grammar school, one of the reasons they sacked me was I learned that there was massive windows, and if I took my Watkins Rapier 33 in, I could put the neck on the window and everybody in the class could hear it.
Oh,
so I sit there doing that during lessons, and they didn't really like that. Yeah. But they wouldn't let me in the choir or the orchestra, which is, so I thought, well, yeah, I'll just do what I want. And then this happened.
So
I went to school, comprehensive, which is so different. It had girls and everything. It was wonderful. And bands, and I was in bands, and we used to play in assembly, totally different attitude. And then this happened as well. So there you go.
And you went on tour in Europe at a very early age. How did, thinking about my own time in bands, it was very hard to even get in a band or make the contacts. So you found yourself off to Europe when you were, what, 16?
16, yeah. One O-level I took and then left and went to Europe.
So. And what was that like? Did that really reinforce?
O-level.
Yeah.
The O-level, I failed. And it's English, and I'm quite good at English.
Yeah. So
So what was it like?
Yeah, the tour of Europe. What was it like at that age going out? Who were you with? What was the band?
Well, it's kind of strange. There was a school friend and I just used to play together, and then somehow we got a band together. And I sort of forgot all about it because I was doing other stuff. One day, literally, knock on the door, do you want to come to Denmark with us? So I said, well, yeah, why not? Mm-hmm. So we went. We spent, first gig was a month's residency in a club called Your Father's Moustache. And we had about half a set, so we were learning songs in the day and then sort of trying them out on audiences. And it was quite amazing, yeah, and it went down very well, and we had a great time. And at 16 in Copenhagen, it's wow, yes, it was a learning.
Roughly went process. What year was this, Robin? Roughly when that was all happening? Can you remember?
I don't know. I have absolutely no idea. Late 70s? No, middle 70s.
And
must be. I started with Dave in 70s. So yeah, no. Early 70s.
And who were you listening to around that time? who were your influences as you started out?
Well, as usual, the Beatles, the Stones, and then Fleetwood Mac. I thought Peter Green, what a guitar player, you know. He had the blues, man.
Yeah.
Johnny Winter, Edgar Winter. Or just anything that was good, but I had mates who were into soul. So if I went to their house, we'd be listening to Motown, etc. They came to my house, we'd be listening to rock and, of course, Zeppelin, and, you know, so on and so forth. So I had quite a broad upbringing, and I still love soul because I was forced to.
I think that comes. No, I think that comes because you around this, even around this, when you're in this very tentative age, when you first started out, you started to network with people quite early on, didn't you? You know, yeah. Where? How did you find that a natural thing? I mean, how? Where did you go to meet people? Where were you, or was it the tour that did it?
No, it was there was a fab record shop in Wolverhampton called Gould's TV.
Oh yeah,
and I used to Saturdays and opposite Saturday morning Gould's TV. Opposite was a guitar shop, and you see that acoustic.
Oh
there?
Yeah,
the guy who owned the guitar, he gave me that because I loaned him my flat for his liaison set, and that was his reward. The first ever fiberglass back guitar.
Wow!
And the guy is from. He didn't patent it. Evasion did. And but it's still rough. He never sanded it down or anything, but it's the most fantastic sounding, beautiful guitar. It's never been EQ'd. You just shove a good mic in front of it and play, and she does what she does.
The other thing I think that sets you apart is that you became very efficient at finding your way around a recording studio, didn't you? You self-taught yourself engineering and producing.
Yeah.
Did you have a natural interest in that, and how did you go about that?
When I was a kid, I was lucky enough that I had two cassette decks. So I'd play guitar on one, copy it to the other while I was singing or soloing, and so that was the start, two cassette decks. And I just progressed, then I got a 4-track, then I got an 8-track, then I got 16, then 24, and my peak, I had the most beautiful studio, 880s, van, horses, and it got robbed and they took everything.
Oh, no.
Everything. Desk. It was the first time, last time I ever remember actually bursting into tears when I walked in that morning. Everything.
Oh.
All the Bandier stuff there. Yeah. All the, you know, everything. But thank heavens they left my guitar. So they must have known me, whoever did it. And I haven't known. I think I know. But anyway, they wiped me out.
Oh, dear.
Couldn't work for a while. So, but anyway, so the reason I then got into it was I was recording with Daniel Boone, as in Beatles Sunday. Yep. And Daddy, Don't You Walk So Fast. My missus still bursts into tears when she hears that. Anyway, I was recording a fabulous engineer, and he had to go. And there was nobody else to do it. So I just thought, well, I'll do it then. And just went on. Then I started doing sessions with, you know, Roy Wood and obviously David Byron.
Yeah.
It just went on and on and on. So,
The next thing I wanted to ask you about was the album History, which is what year was that? Was that the early 80s?
Stop asking me years, Phil. I do not know. What year is it now for heads? I don't
know. Who knows?
Anyway,
I think, well, you were still. Because I can see why you were later on. I'll ask you this in a bit more detail when Duran Duran came after you to see if you wanted to join them. But you had kind of this perfect pop rock crossover. And now that you've said who you were influenced by, I can see that you weren't your typical listening to Purple, Sabbath, Zeppelin rock guitar person. You obviously you were listening to a broad range of music, and obviously pop and soul. And so that probably set you apart with what people might have expected. Have you always just found that easy, just to write music that crossed over different genres?
I don't do it on purpose. It's just the way it comes out.
It comes out.
I mean, I was really into early Bolan and, you know, T-Rex, obviously.
Yeah.
And a lot of my stuff reviewers say, well, that sounds a bit like T-Rex. It's not on purpose. It's just what's inside me, I suppose, trying to struggle its way out.
How do you feel about the album history now? Is it something you play or?
No, I never, ever listen to stuff. Once it's released, unless it's on in a pub or a club or somebody else is playing it, I don't play my records. Then why would I have heard them millions of times?
Yeah, that's very, very true. I'd like to ask you about because you just mentioned David Byron, the ex-Uriah Heep vocalist, because you did a couple of albums with him, didn't you? I mean, I've got, I think On the Rocks is the one I like the most. Some great songs on that, some great, you know, performances. When you met him, he'd been right up there in the biggest band you could probably imagine with all the limousines and everything else. And he was probably in leaner times. Had he adapted to the idea of almost like starting again? How did you find working with him?
Well, the first time I ever met David, he was unconscious outside the pub opposite the studio. Tom Thompson, the drummer, had brought him along to meet me. And between me and Tomo, we managed to get him up back into the pub. And we slumped him in a chair, got a beer and sat and just watched him waking up. And my best mate, John Woolbridge, drove me there. And the first thing he did, pointed at John and said, what the fuck are you looking at? And he was like, hi, David, I'm Robin. I'm here to meet you. And he's like, oh, hello. And it went on from there, but he was fantastic to me. I mean, you can't work so in depth with people without falling in love with them, like brotherly love, or sister.
I know what you mean.
So you form immense bonds because you're pouring your hearts out to each other and sharing your innermost thoughts with you when you're writing. So we became very close. Spent months and months living with him in Reading, Sonny, it was, sorry.
Yeah,
and with his gorgeous German wife and his Alsatians and. Then my career started taking off and we somehow just drifted apart, really. But the days with the Byron Band, they were great. And no, it wasn't a come down to him. He loved it. There's live tracks on the Lost and Found album and you can hear he's having an absolute ball. So are the audience.
Yeah.
I think we're in Liverpool. He says 300 Liverpool faces. And the cheer is, of course, immense. But the riots were literally going on outside and every gig we did during that tour was riots. When we played the Lafayette, which is one of the best circuit gigs ever in Wolverhampton.
Oh, yeah, I know it.
The same guy who drove me to the David meeting was my best man. It was the day of my bloody wedding. And we got outside and there was bricks, rocks, crowbars, everything. He said, I'm not letting you out of the car, and drove off. So David and the band were stuck in the pub all night. And I've since met people who were at that very night going, why didn't you turn up, you brat? And
yeah.
So it was the first gig I've ever missed, but no way was he letting me out of the car, so I had to get them.
Yeah. Wow. And I think it was as your career was starting to take off, you then worked for a bit with Roy Wood. Was that around the same time, yeah?
I'd been engineering at the Smithy in Worcester for Roy, and I don't know quite how it happened, but I was just playing around with the guitar when he arrived one day. I didn't even know he was in there. And he said, oh, do you want to come and have a go with the band? And I said, well, yeah, I'd love to, because I loved Roy's voice and Blackberry Way. I thought it was great. So it was kind of, I'll have a go. And then next thing I know, it was a Christmas tour. And it was absolutely fab. People love Roy because Roy's very lovable, basically. So.
Yeah, he's a proper Brummie. And you've not lost your accent either, has it? It's still.
What do you mean, mate? Would you talk about that? Like, I don't know how much my fucking accent.
Yeah, all right.
No, I grew up on the good side of Wolverhampton, if there is such a thing.
Yeah.
And went to grammar school and the great prep. And all that stuff.
Well, it was
so if you were accusing me of I'm proud.
Yeah, not at all. I think that area of the country has produced some of the best musicians, I think, in any genre of music, haven't they? It's just endless.
or indeed the world.
Or indeed the world. In fact, you know, we even invented some of the genres of music out there with Sabbath and stuff. So, and bringing us into the more metal end of the spectrum, the next thing that you were involved in was Diamond Head, who would go on to influence one of the biggest metal bands in the world, Metallica. And how did you get involved with Diamond Head?
Basically, I was again in the Smithy in Worcester, and they came in to record a single, and I was engineering, and then just producers, and I'm managing them, and Sean's mom, Linda, said, yeah, please produce it. And it was called Sweetening Innocent. And I used to call it Sleeping in a Tent, which they didn't quite get. But anyway, it turned out how it turned out. And but I only did the single for them, not the album.
Oh, you didn't do the album. So, okay. No. But you had...
But the single was...
Yeah. Did you feel at the time that they would be so influential?
Well... it was before Metallica. What happened was that Metallica came up with, I think, three of their songs, and of course, you know, they're still very happy about it, especially when they talk these days.
Yeah.
Because it's the only way you get any money anymore.
Yeah.
Diamond Head were Diamond Head. They were Dad Sean, and they were very special for that alone, you know. I was working with him last year, the year before last, we got back together with Notorious. And then suddenly he said, do it anymore. You want to hear a black country accent? Sean's got it. And would you think it to hear him sing? But I've always loved his voice, loved working with him, but he has his ups and he has his downs. Sean is Sean. But we did five tracks in a week. We came over here and it's sounding immense. But I haven't listened or touched it since, because one day he might come back to the fold, one day he might not. You know. But it's good.
Yeah,
he's still got it. Definitely,
because you
and he's still nuts. Definitely,
you worked with him after this, didn't you? Before the recent time when you had almost like a record of the week, didn't you, on Radio One? Is that?
Yeah, we did. Swark.
Yeah,
the Swark. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, he's
Simon Bates. I think I'd forgotten, but you put it in a note. So thanks. It's funny though, because Radio One were really good to me generally. So, Tommy Vance, Heartline Record of the Year, Fluff Freeman, Heartline Record of the Year, and Tommy did Dangerous Music Album of the Year. So, and they were both really great people, and I was so proud to have known them, be able to listen to them play my stuff, and it was great, super.
Well, just before we get to that point, you also with the Climax Blues Band, and great band. And I listened to the album that you were on just a few days ago, and did you feel that you were pointing them into a slightly more modern direction?
Not at all. I only played on, during rehearsals, yeah, definitely. And then, but I only played a bass of all things.
Oh, really?
On one track. But Pete and I really hit it off big style. And lost touch for a while, then Tomo, yet again the guy who discovered David with me on the floor, put me back in touch with Pete, and then we made an album, put a band together. It's an absolutely fantastic band, did an album, and then of course in this day and age it's still sitting on the shelf, really. It's a shame. Really good album.
Well, I know you don't like doing dates or years, so I think hopefully I've got this one right, but I think it's about 1983 now, and now you're everywhere before you start to break out on your own, and you're producing Witchfinder General, your Quartz, Magnum, you've got a song covered by Ted Nugent, you've also doing Wrathchild's Stack Attack. Now a lot of these are to do with some of them are to do with Heavy Metal Records and Paul Birch. How did you get involved with Paul?
Well, I'd always known Paul from a distance. And who else is going to produce your record if you're in Wolverhampton? You know, I mean, there ain't many of us there that I know of anyway. So I became, I wouldn't have said it at the time, but their sort of in-house producer, which is why. And I mean, you can imagine Witchfinder General. That's such a laugh to record. It really was. and Stack Attack. I mean, again, we did Witchfinder General, recorded it in Coventry, but Stack Attack we did in London at DJM Studios, who I was signed to them as publishing, so natural thing to go to. And they used to come, I insisted on 10 o'clock in the morning starts, because, you know, rock and roll and all that. And they used to come in on the tube through Rush Hour in their full stage regalia.
Wow.
Now, there was not many empty seats. There was many empty seats, even in packed trains. There was gaps around everywhere, but they were such fun to work with. And great, I really enjoyed it, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think they wanted to be the UK's version of Kiss, didn't they, really?
They were sort of, they had, I don't know, I think I've just asked somebody to try and get me the album again, because I haven't heard it since. As I said, I don't listen to stuff, but I think they should have made it. Just back to Heavy Metal Records or Revolver, whatever they were called at that time, yeah. Paul. They put an album out, they did this with Stack Attack.
So now we're moving to 1985, and as you just mentioned earlier, that the year when Alan Freeman, Tommy Vance, we're going to make you album and track of the year with Dangerous Music and Heartline. What was that like when that came out? Did you know that you'd got something on your hands that was going to make that kind of impact?
Well, sort of. I was lucky enough, very lucky enough, to be signed to Bronze Records. Jerry Bron, who was like an uncle to me really in the end, he's a great bloke, bless him. He came in to listen to the playback, and after Heartline, he said, if you've got an album full of stuff like that, you're going to be, you know, megastar. And, well, I hadn't. But so yeah, if a guy of his, you know, I mean, when you think of Motorhead and many other bands that he was, you know, involved with and made who they became, it's quite incredible. So, I was given clues, and then, of course, all the TV and we were touring, and which is why, really, I missed so many opportunities. I wish I'd have taken, like, Asia and, of course, you know, anyway, we'll talk about that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I had an idea. I had an idea.
Because you're on the front page of Kerrang. You were just everywhere. I mean, you know, I remember that myself. You know, I was with bands in the Midlands and thinking, well, you know, this guy's just, you know, he's like a rocket now. He's just heading everywhere. And I've seen, obviously, the videos, you know, they still hold up and look great today. You know, it's a fantastic track, fantastic production, great styling and everything. I noticed also that you took on board another guitarist. It was Hugh Lewis from the band Trouble. Because I used to see Trouble a lot at the railway in Birmingham. They were a great band.
Great pub,
yeah. So do you work with Hugh? Have you ever worked with him again, or did you still stay in touch?
No, but he crops up a lot, and he's always credited anything he's on. He's, you know, given his due for, of course. But no, just not really in touch. He was a great lad. He was daft as a brush. One of my favourite memories. We were in somewhere in Hamburg or somewhere in Germany, and we went for a curry, and he would not believe that the Asian waiters weren't from Birmingham. He would not have it. There was as German as you come. But yeah, he was a great lad and a good player, very good player.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he wouldn't have been in the band, obviously.
So when this was this, obviously with all the media spotlight on you with this album, is that when you had other things coming in, like the invite to potentially be in a band like Asia and the Duran Duran? Was that also around this time?
Number one, Duran Duran, total myth.
Oh, right.
They didn't ask me, and I wouldn't have joined them anyway. I mean, you know, if I join a band, they've got to have a singer.
Yeah.
I'd never have joined that. Pete Green, as in Daniel Boone, used to say, you know, if you're going to sing out of tune and in front, just do it in private, not sort of. Anyway, so no, that is a myth. It never happened.
Right.
But it was good publicity. So,
yeah. I bet it was, yeah. Because they could almost see that. You could almost see how that came about because of the way that you presented yourself. You weren't like a typical hair metal type guy. You were stylish. You crossed, again, you... It was rock music, but it was also very, as Jerry Bronn had said, Heartline was a fantastic, it was a pop song, it was a rock song, it was both. It could have gone either way, you know. Absolutely brilliant. So what happens next is you actually start working with almost a revamped Thin Lizzy.
Yeah.
So what was it, not a thing to follow up Dangerous Music with another solo album, or did you?
I went straight from Dangerous Music into, you know, the second album.
Yeah.
Third, if you include History. Yeah. So I had all that ready to go under my belt, but no. Phil and I, first time I met him, again, at the Lafayette in Wolverhampton. I saw Lizzie standing at the bar, and Phil was next to me, and we just started chatting, and just, you know, as people in the pub, the club.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, he's a nice guy. Next time I saw him, I was auditioning for Lizzie when the medal left. And anyway, years later, when we re-met, he said, I didn't get the job. Obviously, Snowy White did it, which is a terrible move for everybody concerned, I'm afraid to say. But they did it, and, you know, it went well. But then when I met Phil properly, he said he wanted me in the band, and it was just politics and all that sort of stuff. Obviously, it must have been, I don't know, another guitar player who didn't want me in. But it was amazing times, really. And then, you know, what happened was I was, again, in DJM Studios recording, I was recording Showdown, which I think that's on History. I don't know, so many albums, so it's hard to remember. But anyway, the point, it's on Dangerous. I've just been tipped off from my beautiful, thank you, darling. what are you doing in here? And a dog. Oh, hello, Willem. Anyway, he said he wanted me in, and then we were writing together and at his gorgeous sort of mock Tudor mansion in Kew. And I just remember just such fond memories. We just got on so well. So then we went to do TV show, and we had to fly to Newcastle with Brian Downey as well.
Yeah.
He was a lovely man, I've got to say. He's a lovely man, I still presume. And on the way back, he said, right, I'm going to reform Lizzie. Do you guys want to be in? And we said, nah, of course not. Let's do it. So then we carried on writing, and we were recording. He had a little studio in his shed with a Brenelec track recorder, exactly the same as I had at the time.
Yeah.
And it was just magical, and we were recording stuff. And then the inevitable happened, and we lost him. And it was terrible, terrible times. And I still miss him now, to be honest with him. We were like brothers in the end. It was great. I remember sitting in his bedroom, cross-legged on the floor, acoustic guitar each, smoke, a drink, and just writing stuff that neither of us had ever heard before. And it was great, super. Recorded it all. Then when we lost him, we lost all the tapes. Mm-hmm. God knows who's got them. I've put out searches. Nothing's come up, and people have tried. But they've gone, but not forgotten.
Oh, that's that is such a shame. The video on YouTube of you playing on the track, is it 19? Probably, is it from that show? You look as if you're having the time of your life.
We both were. Yeah. I mean, as I say, we got on great, and Brian was just great as well. So it was just like a band of brothers, if you like.
Yeah.
So it's been done.
Yeah, your guitar playing and you know you just slotted in to if Thin Lizzy had carried on, you'd have slotted in just perfectly.
Yeah, but that was the plan, and then it wasn't. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, bless him. I love him.
You also then worked. You also worked with another heavy metal records band, or Revolver Records, which was Martial Law. Who were a bit like Priest, weren't they? I think, if I remember rightly.
They were Priests too, without a shred of a doubt. But I've got to say that Dave, the guitar player, is better than anything Priest ever came up with.
Oh, it's right.
Really good. Yeah, Dave Martin, that's it.
Yeah, fantastic.
And Andy Pike, the singer, and I remember sitting outside at Bridge North in the studio before it went, writing, I think, No Justice.
Yeah.
That was a song. And they were just real fun to work with, and really professional, and just got the job done, and
Brilliant.
There you go. It was one of those records, like in the old days, recorded in a week, mixed in a few days, and boy, I changed it.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear it again. I really would, so I will one day.
Yeah. Well, the next person I want to ask you about is someone who I really like myself, and that's you collaborated with Glenn Hughes on the track Haunted, which is used in the movie, was it Highlander? Highlander 2?
Highlander 2. Highlander 2.
Yeah.
The worst follow-up film ever. For example, my beautiful dad-in-law watched the whole film and he had to switch it off in the end. He heard the song and then switch it. He couldn't watch it, nor could I. Went to see it in the flick of the opium in Brum, and when it was a cinema. And I had to leave and come back in just to see my credit at the end. It was terrible. I've never seen it.
I've never seen that. I've only seen the first one, which I really like. So you've not sold it to me. But that's a great track. And obviously, Glenn Hughes, around that time, that was probably when he was still in his troubled period, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So that was the case. It was.
Well, again, amazingly, totally professional. You know, we did a whole album, didn't you?
No, I didn't, no.
Oh, yeah. We co-wrote and I produced. It's called Sweet Revenge. Never went out. I sent a purportedly record company very low-quality version. The book is released, it, so it's a bootleg. But strange you should bring it up, because it's being remastered right now. And it's a great album. And the point I was going to make was, Glenn was, you know, he's doing stupid amount of drugs and etc. And then we'd stand up and sing. And, well, I'll send you some MP3s of the album. You're going to like it.
Yeah, that's really exciting news to think that album is going to see the light of day, because that's going to be really exciting, you know, for fans of Glenn and for people to really put spotlight on yourself as well, really. I mean, that sounds great, because that track Haunted is fantastic. So what was the album similar? Well, I guess it was just you and Glenn's style, was it? Did you write together?
Yeah, we wrote, I think, two or three tracks together. The rest were mine. And some pretty damn good versions of them from Glenn.
Yeah.
I mean, he was like, I don't know, doing ridiculous amounts of cocaine and ecstasy and whatever you could think of. And he was also incredibly overweight. I've got videos.
Yeah, I did notice that he's a lot bigger there than he is now. Yeah, I didn't.
Yeah, well, last time I saw him at JB's in Dudley years ago, and I was with Mel Galley and the guitar player from Trapeze and Whitesnake. Yeah. And he was thin as a rake again. So that's cocaine for you, mate.
Yeah.
Binge.
There you go. So is Glenn Hughes also aware that this album's coming out? Is he part of,
Not at the moment. No, it's very, very difficult to get hold of. But, I mean, we recorded it so many years ago in my studio. I paid for it all. I mean, then we did go into fantastic studios. But the album is the original versions from my house, because they just couldn't beat him, really.
Well, that's really exciting news. And then we bounced from one bass player to another, which is Pete Way from UFO.
Darling Pete.
Yeah.
And Pete.
I mean, he was also a bit of a party person, whereas Glenn's kind of mellowed and sorted, gone down a straighter route, Pete was always a rock and roll party person, wasn't he?
Yeah, he certainly was. I mean, he was like the archetypal rock and roll star, really. Fantastic.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the thing with Pete was that, you have to fall in love with people, whatever the faults. And, boy, he had a few, but just so many memories that are quite incredible, because then I did a tour with Wasted, which is Pete's band, obviously.
Yeah.
And that was a laugh, I've got to tell you. Good God. But again, a total professional. He could be absolutely, I mean, he stayed over at my place with the studio in Wolverhampton, not Bridgenorth.
Yeah.
And you'd offer him a glass of water for overnight. Nope, he'd have a bottle of wine by his bed, white wine. And you'd wake up in the morning and you'd go.
Good God.
Yeah, he was the most serious alcoholic I've ever known, but he functioned.
But he still did his stuff, didn't he?
Yeah, he didn't. And then, unfortunately, another one bites the dust, man.
But the music you on the Wasted album you did, and then Damage Control, it still stands up to me. That, you know, the great, great records, you know.
Yeah, I only mixed the Wasted album, but Damage Control was totally mine.
Yeah, as it were. That should have. Is that? I don't know if there's a remastered version of that out. Well, there should be. I mean, that should get that. That really should have a wider boost.
Yeah, it should. I mean, it's a very good rock and roll record. It's the right foot mood, right words, right vibe.
Yeah,
Spike great on it, and
there's it might
be like, what a drummer.
You know? It'd be the kind of thing that if you know the reissue label Rock Candy Records, it's the kind of thing that they should do as a project.
It's sort of difficult because I sort of was in. I was just releasing. Well. Making records, no outlet. So in the end, I signed stuff with Angel Air Records.
Oh, yeah, Angel Air, yeah.
Yeah, what they are great at is getting them out to CD. Then they do nothing. There's no promotion. It's all changed. Peter, who ran it, had plans and a different idea. But the new guy who, you know, we're in negotiation with this rock star album
yeah.
at the moment. So hopefully, but... You know, it's a bit like Paul Birch. Put it out, see what happens. Mm. No great vibe.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think Damage Control is a very valid album.
Totally. I'll put a link to this the album on Spotify. I think in my web post when I do this. I think it needs to be heard by more people. And then we come to a project that's got so many names on it that it looks like a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which is Love, Power and Peace.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Now tell us a bit about this, because this is epic.
I don't really know what to say. I started out thinking somehow. I thought, well, it's time to give a bit back somehow, and we did a single for Macmillan Cancer, obviously, yeah. And. Which was really, it was Love, Power and Peace, the song. So it had, you know, a myriad of, as you said, Rock and Roll Hall of Fames on it. And the Nurses put their own record out the week before Love, Power and Peace came out, which just swamped it. I thought it was kind of a strange move. We were only trying to make money for the people who need it, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we did the single, and I just thought, I might as well make it an EP, do four or five tracks. And suddenly, I'm in touch with people who put me in touch with other people. I think it ended up in total with over 100 people, including the choirs that it said.
Wow.
So probably 60, maybe 70 individual stars from the world of rock.
Well, yeah, you said with members from Alice Cooper, AC/DC, UFO, Asia, Diamond Head, Motorhead, Uriah Heep, Duran Duran, Mott the Hoople, Marshall Law, Climax Blues Band, Ruby Turner, Arthur Brown, Jackie Graham, Charlie George, Freya Copeland. It just goes on and on.
Yeah. Freya was in, what was her project? Yeah. Emmerdale. She was the copper in Emmerdale, by the way. Oh. Angie the copper. I never saw it, but I'm told. So. Anyway, yeah. So then we set up this session in Birmingham. Oh, God, what a day that was. And there was probably, how many, 100 people milling about. We went to Urbana's studio. Who donated? Everybody on it, by the way. Nobody took a penny. All for the right reason. Nobody asked for a penny, apart from Pete Way. He said, can I have my taxi fare back, Walt? And I said, no, you blimmy car. Can't. So he pulled a can of Super out of his great big coat pocket and gave it me, and that was the end of negotiations.
That's true.
What a darling. I do miss it. Matt.
So, yeah, I mean... So
anyway, it was just fantastic, and all these people, I mean, this what we did a version of Little Help From My Friends, the Beatles, and the vocals, Sean sings it, and Jackie Graham sings it, Jackie Williams sings it, and did a me. And there's seven, I think, guitar solos on it.
Yeah.
And I don't know why I did it, but boy, was it difficult to do, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
But in this age of technology, it's just sit here and do it.
Yeah, that's true. So is your other big project, the Rockstar Legends project, is that was that inspired by your Love, Power and Peace project, or is it just another part of your creativity? You thought, I know what, I want to do this next.
Well, no, what happened is, I suppose it's partly due to lockdown, etc., which is very different here from anywhere else. It's much sort of, anyway, I just thought, what am I going to do? And I thought, well, I've got all this stuff in the vaults from all these fantastic people I'm so lucky to have known, written and worked with and performed with. I thought, why not try and put it together? And so that's where it came from. And it's very bittersweet to do. You know, I miss so many of them so much. You know, I won't list because there's too many. But listening to them again and editing and mastering, etc., it's sort of... But now it's done, I just think it's keeping their memories alive, I hope, as well. So,
I mean, personally, I think it's an absolutely unique project, and I don't think anyone else could do something like that. It's because you're... Not only are you an artist and songwriter and... A name in yourself, but because you've done all this recording and you're someone that sits behind the desk as well, you've collected all of this stuff and you've got access to it, whereas you haven't had to go across like 55 different record companies asking for permission from different people. You've got it all, that you've compiled this. And I was looking at it, it's unique, isn't it? And as you say, a lot of those people are now no longer with us. It's a fantastic project, you know.
To me, it's a tribute to them all as well. So, let's hope people do like it, because I think some of, you know, as it says in the sleeve notes, everybody played or sang or did backing vocals or co-wrote. So it's a real good example, you know. And, of course, you know, people like John Wetton, you know, it was just so great to work with.
Well, yeah, that's another guy as well, isn't it? It's just fantastic to look at. When I looked at the cover and you see all those different people like John Wetton and, you know, David Byron, Phil Lynott, and you think all of these people all are connected, you know, that you've been involved with all these people over the years, and you've put this. It looks like a complete labor of love and done with complete respect for all the musicians you've worked with. So, I really hope that really does, you know, does well and continues to sell as well. That's, you know, great stuff.
Did you know ABBA, they've sold a million records and they got £65 from streaming?
God.
They sold actually 6 million, so they got... Anyway, the point is £65 per million. Wonder why we're broke, eh, mate?
Well, I mean, that's why I put together the Now Spinning magazine brand was for... Because I've got a whole community of music collectors around the world, and that, yes, streaming is fine to discover stuff.
Yes.
But once you've discovered it, if you like it, you should buy the record or the CD and support the artist, because by buying the CD, you're closer, you have a closer relationship with the artist that listening to music you've rented will ever give you.
And you put bread on the table as well, mate. I've got to tell you, times are tough, you know.
Yeah.
For musicians worldwide, it's just appalling.
Those of you watching this and listening to it later on, no matter where you are, are some great albums to listen to here and some great albums to purchase and have in your collection. And that brings us to your most recent stuff, which is Wilderness and Heartlands, the acoustic album.
Yeah. Heartlines.
Yeah, sorry. So this was... Is this a labour of love as well? Here it is.
That's... This is out now.
Yeah.
And available through Amazon, everywhere. You can see it's a lovely package. There's a 12-page booklet of rock poetry in it. And they're all a labour of love, really, but it's what I love doing. So, you know, I can't do anything else. I've done loads of things. I've worked in factories, petrol stations, driver. But music is all I can do.
So do you feel that... as we've just talked about streaming, that having a physical product for your fans to purchase is important to you? Because a lot of artists now just think, I'm going to release this digitally and that will do.
Yeah. Well, to answer that, you know, we've got, this is out right now, again, physical. Again. Yeah. To me personally, I still like putting something, prefer vinyl, but I haven't got a record deck anymore. And this one is Next, which is called Feed the Wolf. Again, that's the CD, it's real. And then there's this one. Oh, this is interesting. It's a total instrumental album.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which I've never done before. and it's really quite fun. It took me 3 or 4 days to play the whole album because, of course, I knew the tunes.
Yeah.
So people have, you know, people have heard it, think it's great. It's very, you know, I haven't heard an instrumental album, you know, apart from orchestral, for many moons. So see what happens.
Yeah, that will be good. Again, because of your sense of melody and song structure, that'll be really, really interesting.
Yeah.
So people want to get hold of you or find out where would you recommend they go?
So robingeorge.co.uk, and there's links to Amazon, everywhere else to buy the albums.
And I would recommend that people do buy your albums as well, because and especially these ones that just cover so many different artists that you work with. They're such fantastic projects. But of course, your new acoustic album and the instrumental one looks very good. And obviously, yes, I'm very excited about the Glenn Hughes one as well. I mean, you've got so much going on. I mean, as lockdown has it kind of regenerated your creative juices because you couldn't go out and play?
Yes. And like I said, it's I can't say there's anything good about lockdown, no. But for me, because there was absolutely nothing else really one could do, even though it's always been much freer here. You know, you could go out, you could sit outside a pub, etc. I just stayed here and in the studio and did all this. And so there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and 6 albums during the last, you know, lockdown years. As
well. Wow. Gosh, yeah. when many people in your probably peer group are slowing down, you're speeding up.
Yeah, there's no choice, really. It's got to be done. If I don't do it now, nobody else is going to do it, are they?
So as we come to the end of the interview, are you looking forward to going out on the road? Are you going to start lining up gigs?
I don't really know because. You know, times are so different. But the right tour, the right festivals, yeah, of course, I'd love to play again. Because I still can't play, which is kind of ridiculous. But, I would like to, but it would have to be the right offer, you know.
Yeah, true. And also, just finally, because of what we talked about, you've done so much during the lockdown and the way that the world has changed for music, not always good financially, but the fact that you can... a lot of people playing each other's albums without actually even meeting each other face to face. I mean, Do you get offers to guest or produce or yeah?
Oh yeah. For example, I played on something. I can't remember the name of the band. I'm sorry to say, but if people approach me, yes, of course. If they need help, I'll play for them. It was a guy called it's Sweden Rock Records. Johannes. Lindstrom has put an album together, and he asked me and Lawrence Archer, Grand Slam, to do a solo together on one of his songs. So we did. Met Lawrence very briefly many moons ago with Mark Stanley from Magnum. We were great mates at the time. But other than that, never met him before or since, and we just played together from a distance, and it worked out. It's great. It's coming out soon as well, so. But yeah, I do play, I do sessions, and when people ask me to remix stuff, I do, pleasure. So, mostly pleasure.
Well, thanks. So, yeah. Well, thank you very much, Robin, for spending, giving me your time for this podcast and broadcast. I really, really appreciate it. And everybody, if you're listening and watching this, Heartline's acoustic album is well worth listening to, as well as the entire back catalogue. But please do make sure you buy the CD and support the artist directly. It's fantastic. Thank you. And all the links you'll find at the end of this video underneath the comments. So thanks very much. Been an absolute pleasure, Robin. And hopefully we'll talk again some other time.
Well, I hope so, Phil. I hope so. Well researched. And thanks for your time.
Big thank you to my guest Robin George for being on the show and to all our listeners. To find out more about Robin George and where you can buy his latest album and his other CDs, please visit robingeorge.co.uk. That's robingeorge.co.uk. Also, please subscribe to Now Spinning Magazines to ensure you stay up to date with our future podcasts, videos, and I look forward to being with you on the next episode.